Live and local, we are Acadiana's sports station. 103.7 The Game. KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time for RP3 and Company, where Raymond Parch III and Cody Schutz talk sports with the biggest names in the state of Louisiana. Raging Cajun legend Brian Mitchell.
My dream was always to play in the NFL, so having that opportunity was the main thing I needed.
LSU College World Series hero Warren Morris.
I don't get tired of talking about it. You know, if people remember me for that home run and winning that championship, I think that's great.
Time to find out what's behind that door as RP3 and Company starts now.
Oh yeah, fire stuff. This for New Orleans. Who that nation? Who that? Who that? Take them, go black and gold, black and gold. Don't stop, boy. We trying to win the Super Bowl.
Good morning, Acadiana. Welcome to this edition of RP3 and Company right here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. We're being simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1 Stadium Network. 24 hours of sports coverage. You can give us a call today if you'd like on the ARCO Equipment Hotline, 337-706-0111. That's 337-706-0111. We've got a jam-packed show for you today, ladies and gentlemen. Third hour, we got Nick Suss joining us from the Clarion Ledger. He covers the Ole Miss baseball team. He's going to give us a little perspective, a little insight from the Rebels who'll be taking on the LSU Tigers this weekend at Alex Box Stadium. We'll also have Les East on from CrescentCitySports.com. He's going to give us his thoughts on David Griffin's first hire as the leader of the New Orleans Pelicans, as well as his thoughts on the Saints' draft picks in undrafted free agent signing. Second hour, James Yasko, our friend from the Lima Time Time podcast. He's going to give us his thoughts on kind of an up-and-down week, so to speak, for the Houston Astros. They look really great, look like world beaters one night. The next day, they look a little pedestrian. Early in the season still, but we'll get James's thoughts on the Stros. Also, in the second hour, the defending state champion. That's right. State champion in bass fishing from St. Thomas More High School. Senior Caleb Clark is going to join us. State championships are this weekend down in Morgan City. We're going to talk about that as well as his bond with his grandfather, a Louisiana Sports Hall of Famer, and the first man to win the Bassmaster Classic from the state of Louisiana, Jack Haynes. And coming up this hour, John Marques, our good friend from the Town Talk, towntalk.com, columnist. He's going to share his thoughts about the continuing Will Wade saga and Sean Miller saga in college basketball. We'll also get to Zach Hess being officially moved back to the bullpen as well. But I want to start things off with the Who Dat Nation. The Saints and the state of Louisiana are closing in on a long-term lease extension. And more importantly, a major Superdome renovation. A major renovation. And that's the part that kind of surprised me. So, the Louisiana Superdome, even though it does have the corporate sponsorship with Mercedes-Benz, it is ran by the state. Okay? So, even though the Saints play there, they don't own the facility, okay? And the Bensons don't own it, so it's not as if, you know, it's a situation like the Dallas Cowboys where Jerry Jones owns AT&T Stadium, right? That's his baby. That was his pet project. He invested the money into it and everything like that. So it was released yesterday that the Saints and the state of Louisiana are working towards an agreement that will keep the team in Louisiana through 2035. But this will also include a transformation of the Mercedes-Benz Superdome of a price tag of $450 million. The deal, as I said, would extend the Saints' current lease agreement with the state another 10 years. Right now, the lease comes up in 2025. They would extend it another 10 years. I do believe that will encompass the time that Drew Brees is still remaining as quarterback of the New Orleans Saints. But the renovation part is what is surprising to me. It's the most elaborate and expensive overhaul of the stadium in its 44-year history.
I ain't giving you no tree for this.
Governor John Bel Edwards gave his blessing to the plan during an April 17th meeting with state and team officials that was held in Baton Rouge. That was according to Kyle France, the chairman of the Louisiana Stadium District, which oversees Superdome affairs for the state. Now, team officials, people within the organization say the renovation is necessary to modernize the Superdome. You got to think. The Superdome is trying to put itself in a position of hosting the marquee events. And they're going up against the likes of the new state-of-the-art facility that has been built in Arlington, Texas, and Minneapolis, and New Jersey. All these new football palaces are just that. They're palaces. They have these wide-open concourse areas. There's all this modern, sleek look to them. All the technology that's involved. Everything's very tech-friendly. Massive museums. Different types of gift shops. The Superdome is dated in that regard. Now, the great thing for the Saints is that it's such a home field advantage because it's inside, because you can get loud. That's not going to go away. They just want to modernize the Superdome and make it even more attractive for others' things besides the Saints. Not only do they want to modernize it for the Saints, but they also want to modernize it for national championship games, Final Fours, Super Bowls.
And that's exactly what my point was going to be, is that you have to think outside of the box of just football, and then on top of that, of what you would consider a traditional sport as well. You mean you're talking concerts, not just other types of events, car shows, things, and probably, to me, the second most important thing of all, after the New Orleans Saints, would be the hosting of many future WrestleManias.
Correct. That's another thing.
I mean, these are all economic booms for the New Orleans area. And I mean,
in the facilities that are bidding on these, whether it's WrestleMania, Final Fours, Super Bowls, they all have new stadiums. They all have up-to-date, high-tech kind of stadiums.
And if you think that when the Cajun Dome went through all its renovations, and the Cajun Dome, we know for a fact, was working with, is probably a loose way to say it, but was in contact with WWE about certain things they could do during renovations to make WWE setup for Raw or SmackDown or whatever easier when they come to the Cajun Dome. That's a thing that happened. If it happened here in Lafayette, Louisiana for the Cajun Dome, don't think for 1 second that it didn't happen at probably an even bigger level, or it will happen when these renovations start to take place. WWE and the Superdome and all these other deals, Final Four, and all these other places, they'll be in contact with them to see, hey, what can we do to make it easier for you to come here?
And to get on that point, to make it go further, the state wants this because of the economic impact hosting these events has. Because, first of all, the NCAA wants their national championships, wants their Final Fours to come to New Orleans. They want that. Why? Because of the hotel infrastructure that's already in place, because of the location of the Superdome and how close all the hotels are, and all the food and all the tourism. So if you're the state, you want to have a facility that everyone else wants to come to, because it's going to give, through tourism, it's going to give your economy a shot in the arm.
it's the same concept that was behind the renovations at the Cajun Dome. Hence, we've had Garth Brooks come through since then. We've had
Carrie Underwood's coming.
Miranda Lambert is coming. I mean, now boxing championships are happening there. So it's the same concept as here. It's just on the scale of New Orleans.
Right. Oh, yeah, it's a good comparison. The cost for the project will be shared by the LSED, who's going to pony up $207 million for it. The Saints are ponying up $150 million.
Hey, shout out to Gail. Thank you, Ms. Gail.
That's right. Thank you, Queen. And the state only has to put forth $93 million.
So me and you are only chipping into the $93
million. That's it.
I mean, if you percentage that out, that's not bad. A percentage of other channels are paying over half.
Right. It's a creative funding plan that still needs to be approved by the State Bond Commission, but officials presented this exact plan to State Treasurer John Schroeder last Friday, and a plan to make similar presentations to members of the Bond Commission before its next meeting on May the 16th. Saints President Dennis Lashaw said that unlike previous dome renovations that added revenue-generating suites that bolstered the team's bottom line, this overhaul is focused on keeping an old stadium relevant in a league dominated by new state-of-the-art venues. Quote, the building has to be modernized so we can improve the fan experience. You've been hearing a lot about fan experience lately, haven't we?
That's the most promising thing that you've said in the first 13 minutes of the show today, because I do, as an average earning fan, not the guy that's going to go hang out in the suites and do his thing, I appreciate something like the Skyline Club at LSU. Are those on-deck deals at Alec Box Stadium that are very moderately priced that you can just go hang out and have fun in. When renovations hit a stadium or something like that that doesn't affect me, then it really takes a lot of my fandom to think about what was said there, how it does help the bottom line of the team when you do these things. It's just you got to dig down deep in your fandom to be okay with that, as opposed to, wait, there might be like a back on my seat when I come. Like, all right, yeah, I'm good. Do your thing.
The renovation would approximately be $1 billion cheaper than the market cost of building a new stadium in New Orleans.
You don't need a new stadium.
Right. But that's always the argument, right? When something gets a little dated and older, well, just tear it down and build something new.
All due respect to China, like the Superdome is the eighth wonder of the world. Let's not.
It'd be $1 billion cheaper. The most dramatic feature, this building is iconic, Lashaw said. This building was built in the 70s. I don't think we could build a building of this caliber of the Superdome for $1.8 billion today. And that's true. The most dramatic feature of the work, which, by the way, stems from a master plan that the Saints, the state, and SMG... the company that manages the dome put together, it took them 2 years to come up with this master plan that cost $500,000. Here's some of the most dramatic feature of the work would be a reimagined entry lobbies at the corners of the stadium along Poydras and Champion Square. Okay. Other features that this is going to include: removal of the sideline pedestrian ramps leading fans to the club suite and terrace levels of the building, and replacing them with additional escalators.
So that's inside the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
New East and West sideline club lounges. Expanded 300-level luxury box suites. New end-zone field-level box suites. An expanded plaza and terrace-level concourses.
Mm-hmm. Need that.
New end-zone corner standing room-only viewing decks.
Come on! Like modern stadiums where they know a fan doesn't stay in their seat for an entire game. Go get up, get you a drink, get you some nachos. Raymond.
Yeah.
Keep talking to me.
The new end-zone corner standing room-only viewing decks caught my attention. An expanded team store, retail outlets.
The team store's already huge.
And a Saints Hall of Fame. So that's all going to be right now. The Saints Hall of Fame is over by the practice facility,
well,
right?
No.
Those offices.
The Saints Hall of Fame is at the Superdome, but you have to, you can't get to it from inside the dome.
Correct.
You have to go out of the dome and then wait in a separate line to then get into there. And
so they want to expand that.
Yeah, they need to.
Have it on site, easier access, plus retail outlets.
Retail outlets, to me, retail is not food. Right? I'm asking.
Right.
Retail.
Well,
that,
you
could that just mean more? Could that mean a voodoo barbecue or something
could be
in
something
there?
Like
or
that, right.
could that does that mean you're going to go and there's a.
Well, if you want to increase the. If you want to improve the game day experience, why not have restaurants on site?
Right. And you're not going to put an American Eagle in the Superdome.
No,
you know
there's
what I mean?
Not a Guess Jeans. That
right. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. There's not going to be a Macy's all of a sudden.
Also, a new visiting team locker room. And here's some other information.
That. You know what? I do care about that visiting team locker room because. Well, I guess you don't have to play your state championship there no more. But when the other kids come and, you know, get the chance to play there, no matter if you're in the home or visiting locker room, you should have a cool experience.
This would happen quickly. If approved, construction would take place in four phases over the next 4 years.
I like that.
Starting in January 2020 after either the college football playoff championship game on January 13th or the NFC championship game on January 19th. Most of the major work would occur during the next four Saints off seasons, causing the stadium to essentially be closed for most non-football events other than Essence Fest, the 2020 College Football Playoff Championship game, and the men's NCAA Final Four in April of 2022. Okay?
So they're grandfathering those things in because it seems like that's already been booked.
Officials hope to complete the project, all four phases, before New Orleans hosts Super Bowl in February 4th, 2024.
So what you're telling me...
That's going to be a tight timeline.
Thanks,
so I feel the state's going to get this approved, and I think they're not going to be messing around, bro.
Well, you're telling me I have to wait till 2025 for my next WrestleMania in New Orleans. Because if the renovations are done in 24, you can bet your bottom dollar WWE will be here in 25.
Yeah.
So... But especially without being able to come at all between then or now and then.
So it looks like the Saints and their home, that's been locked up, but their home is going to become state of the art, not only in the NFL, but in the entire country, if this plan is approved by the Bond Commission, which I anticipate it will be because it's got the support of state lawmakers on both sides of the aisle and the governor. So
go odd job on that Bond Commission, then I'll pass this.
We got to hit a break. This is RP3 and Company on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company right here on 103.7 The Game. I'm your host, Raymond Parse III. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. Simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1 Stadium Sports Network. Give us a call on the ARCO Equipment Hotline if you like, 337-706-0111. So it finally happened. Cody, we spent months on this show talking about, is Zach Hess a starter? We've had guests come on our show saying Zach Hess is not a starter, that he should be in the bullpen. But Paul Maneri, he called Zach Hess his dude, right?
I'm the dude.
That's right. Zach was his dude, man. He's not the Lebowski, he's the dude.
I'm the dude, disguised playing a dude, disguised as another dude.
And yesterday, it was leaked last week that Maneri was wanting to put Zach back in the bullpen. But then Henry had the arm soreness because every LSU pitcher on staff apparently is suffering from arm soreness. And Zach had to go out there and pitch against Alabama. He got shelled. But Marceau was good in the Sunday role, the freshman, Landon Marceau. Then Eric Walker seems like he's coming back fully from injury. He pitched well on Saturday. So they needed a Friday night guy. And they liked having Walker on Saturday and Marceau Sunday. They wanted to put Henry there, the true freshman who's been their best pitcher and most consistent pitcher, as the Friday night starter. Well, it came out yesterday. Zach Hess is back into the bullpen, and it's not Henry as your Friday night starter. Because apparently Henry, MRI came back negative, but they're still being cautious with their young star. So they're going to throw out Mikhail Hilliard as the Friday night starter this weekend at Alex Box Stadium for the three-game stand against the visiting Ole Miss Rebels. We'll hear more about the Ole Miss Rebels in the third hour from our good friend Nick Suss. So, Hess is back in the bullpen. And he's happy about it. Like, Hess is happy about it. That's the thing. He's happy about it.
Maneri said, on the surface, at least, right?
Well, no, he's like...
You feel that he is genuinely...
I feel that he's genuinely... You know, this is what Maneri had to say yesterday. I just want him to go back to being who he is, which is the Wild Thing. Well, you tried to make Wild Thing your starting pitcher. Wild Thing is the guy that comes in, throws heat, attacks the batters, is very aggressive, goes after him, and doesn't have to worry about pitching 5 to 6 innings. He's a two-inning, two-and-a-half-inning max kind of guy that has filthy stuff that can pitch probably at the next level. But Maneri, because of whatever reason, they wanted to push Zach Hess as a starting pitcher. He wasn't very good last year. He was average at best. He worked on his craft in the offseason, in the summer, with Team USA, and in summer ball. And he became the Friday night starter, which is a big deal at LSU. Look at the list of guys who have been Friday night starters. A lot of pros on that list. A lot of guys playing at the next level. But Maneri, since Media Day back in January, has repeated that Hess is his dude. That no matter what, Hess will be the Friday night starter this season. And yet here we are at the beginning of May, and Hess is back in the bullpen. Hess's last start was Friday against Alabama in Tuscaloosa, where he gave up 5 runs on 4 1/3 innings of work. Hess, Maneri, and pitching coach Dunn agreed earlier in that week that Hess would move back to the bullpen. Then Henry went out with the injury, forcing Hess back into the starting role. Remember, Hess was LSU's star closer in 2017 as he made a College World Series run. He had an ERA of 2.51 in 32 1/3 innings of work in the final 3 months. He was great in the bullpen. I'm at my best when the game is on the line and I need to put my foot all the way down on the gas pedal. That's a quote from Zach Hess. The guy's ready to go back to the bullpen. LSU just got better by moving Zach Hess to the bullpen. It took them months. They finally got other guys to step up to develop to be part of that three-man rotation. Zach's now back in the bullpen. When we come back here on RP3 and Company, we'll talk to our good friend John Marques from the Town Talk here on 103.7 The Game. Date. Welcome back to RP3 and Company here on 103.7 The Game. I am your host, Raymond Parts III. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing, simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1 Stadium Network, your new 24-hour sports news network. Started off the show talking about the renovation master plan and lease extension for the New Orleans Saints and the Louisiana Superdome. We also briefly touched on Zach Hess finally being pushed back to the bullpen where he thrives. He's at his best when he's at LSU coming out of the bullpen and not as a starter. But now it's time for us to head out to the ARCO Equipment Hotline and welcome on our first guest of today's jam-packed show. He is a senior columnist for The Town Talk and thetowntalk.com. He joins us every Thursday. It's our good friend John Marques. John, how are you this morning?
Doing well, Ray. How about you?
Doing well. I want to get your thoughts on a multitude of topics, but we'll start off with your latest column that people can go read at thetalenttalk.com, and that's about our good friend Will Wade, the gift that keeps on giving. Just when we think we're done with Will Wade news and the Will Wade saga, something else comes to light on Monday, as it did. You wrote about it, and you basically say that the new athletic director has to make a statement and has to make a change there at the head coach position for the men's basketball team.
Yeah, you know, you don't like advocating for anybody to lose their job. But, you know, if you're Scott Woodward, who really didn't want to touch on the matter at his press conference, and strangely, hardly anybody even wanted to ask him about the basketball program, which shows you the importance of the basketball program at LSU. You know, how many can you willingly sit there and wait for yet another allegation of Will Wade to come out of paying players? I mean, if you go back and you look, and he's already been linked, accused of paying two of their best players, Javonte Smart. He came out this week. The allegation is he offered $300,000 to secure Naz Reid to come to LSU. What's going to be next? I mean, do you really think it's just these two players plus trying to get this high school center out of Florida who ended up committing to, or signing with Florida State? Do you really think that's all that's there now that's come out? You know, and the difference between Will Wade and Sean Miller, who has also been in the news this week, is, you know, it didn't look good for Sean Miller, is on the allegations regarding Will Wade. On two of the allegations, that's Will Wade on the wiretaps, his voice trying to arrange the payments. You know, it's just not a good look. And if you're Scott Woodward, how much longer are you willing to allow this to just hang over the program? Because say you keep him around and the NCAA being the NCAA decides not to do anything, it's still going to hang over your program forever. As long as he's your basketball coach, it's going to be hanging there. And do you really want to start your tenure off with that cloud hanging over you? Or, plus, you know, your stepson's married to Mark Emmert's daughter. You know, like I said, that should be a nice Thanksgiving meal if you've got Will Wade, who might be the new Jerry Tarkanian, as your men's basketball coach.
I wasn't expecting a shark rep, but I like it. I appreciate that coming to the table. John, what would you say to people where it's just allegations? There's no NCAA investigation right now. There's been no federal charges. There's no state charges that have been brought against Will Wade. So as of right now, it's what conversations are that we hear on wiretaps and what other people are saying. And some of these other people are admittedly shady characters, convicted felons themselves. What do you say to the people that bring that up and say, well, there's no actual proof?
Well, he is. I mean, that's the difference. Will Wade, and like I said, I don't know if it's his naivete. Is he in his 30s? He's just starting out in his coaching career. He doesn't know better than the head coach is not the one that needs to be caught on wiretaps, you know, paying players. It needs to be your assistant coaches so you can deny it like Bill Self has done and others have done. The key is Will Wade is on wiretaps, at least two wiretaps. And how do you know the NCAA hasn't already begun investigating? If you go back to the first federal trial that took place back in the fall, you know, some of the allegations that came out of that, the NCAA has launched investigations. And the bottom line is Will Wade has now been accused of three major violations. I'm talking about major violations. And the danger for LSU is if they don't do something, is the NCAA comes in, they find Will Wade is guilty of this, the LSU men's basketball program. Well, not only is the men's basketball program going to be put on probation, but the whole LSU athletic department for non-compliance and, for lack of institutional control, which is the last thing LSU needs or last thing a new athletic director wants.
So you feel that LSU has cause right now?
I do. And I go back to the thing, if you're Will Wade and all the allegations start surfacing, the Yahoo report that came out in March, and you're innocent, why wouldn't you directly go and meet with your bosses and say, this isn't me. I don't know who's doing this. I'm innocent. You know, instead you got your defense attorney saying, hey, you don't need to meet with him. Well, the allegation this week was he paid $300,000 for Nas Reed. Now I know why your defense attorney didn't want you to go meet with LSU officials or NCAA officials. I mean, and let's face it, college coaches are fired for less than this. But, I mean, how much longer are you going to allow this to be the story at LSU? It's like, all right, what's the Will Wade allegation this week?
We're talking to John Marques, senior columnist for the Town Talk and thetowntalk.com. John, when's the last time LSU really had to deal with something like this, the magnitude of this?
You know, the last time that I can recall they had a major issue, and, you know, the NCAA rule book is such that every athletic program is going to violate an NCAA rule at some point or fashion, whether they're major violations or minor violations is, you know, I know football had an issue during, I think, Les Miles' early in Les Miles' term, but they handled it. The NCAA was agreed with, I think they reduced some scholarships or something, so it wasn't really major. But the last time you had a major issue was at the end of Dale Brown's tenure as men's basketball coach, and involved one of the, in my opinion, one of the phoniest good guys out there, Roy Williams, and it involved the Lester Earl situation. Lester Earl was the big hotshot recruit out of Baton Rouge who, if you, you know, I was covering state colleges back then, and if you looked at his recruitment, it was like he would set up all these official visits and then he wouldn't show up. You know, and then he finally decided to go to LSU. The joke was then it was on the Friends and Family program because his brother also came in on scholarships. A couple of his friends from high school came in and on scholarships. Lester Earl lasted, I don't think he even lasted one complete season before he left the LSU program. That would happen to be Dale Brown's final year. There's some speculation that Dale was so frustrated by dealing with Lester Earl and his handlers that that's what caused him to announce his retirement. But after Lester Earl was recruited while he was at LSU to go to Kansas and play for Roy Williams, all these allegations came out. And one of them was, I think, Johnny Jones, who was Dale's top assistant, later became LSU's coach, bought Lester Earl a truck. The NCAA came in and, you know, they hammered the LSU men's basketball program. And, you know, when John Brady succeeded Dale Brown, you know, he was really hamstrung by NCAA violations, scholarship reductions for 2 or 3 years before he could actually get the program up and running. And it's just, in my opinion, another reason why I don't think John Brady gets the credit he deserves for what he did with that program. Taking it to a Final Four. I do think he was fired a year too early because I think he could have led him to another Final Four. But that was probably the last major, you know, so you're talking about the probably late 90s that happened.
John, you believe they have cause now, but Woodward just took over. We know he bleeds mm-hmm. the purple and gold. We know he's, you know, he's an LSU guy through and through. Do you think, though, he's also whip smart? You think he's compiling everything that he needs to make a decision before next season? Do you think that's what's going on right now, in your opinion?
And it could be. The interesting thing is, you know, he just hired Buzz Williams at Texas A&M. So does he have, is he, like, trying to find the possible next replacement? You know, it's a good question. And don't forget, when Will Wade finally met with Joe Oliva and whoever else, one of the conditions of him getting reinstated was they changed his contract so to make it easier to fire him. So, you know, that's going to be the thing to watch as you go through. But, you know, you just wonder how much more is going to come out as long as they continue to wait. And, you know, you look at, you know, Will Wade, like I said, he's the one that's been calling the wiretaps. You look at what's going on in Arizona where they've defended Sean Miller, the school president has even come out to defend Sean Miller, and now you had the allegations yesterday where Sean Miller was paying, you know, two of his top players each month. You know, it's at what point are you willing to let this just implode and take over when everybody talks about LSU, they're going to be talking about the basketball scandal.
Talking to John Marques of the Town Talk and thetowntalk.com. John, well, let's switch gears a little bit. News broke yesterday that the state, the governor is behind it. The state seemingly is behind it. It just has to go to a bond commission, the new 10-year lease extension with the Saints and the Superdome, as well as a massive $450 million renovation project that's going to help make the Superdome a state-of-the-art facility that can be on par with the trend, especially in the NFL, with these majestic palaces being built in Texas and New Jersey and Minnesota, and soon to be Vegas as well. Your thoughts on that news and the fact that they came up with a creative funding plan and that the state really doesn't have to foot the majority of the bill. They have to foot the least amount of money. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't believe anything our state government does. You know, the taxpayers are eventually going to be left holding the bill. We know that. You know, I mean, $400 million is rather cheap now when you're considering, you know, it costs $1.5 billion to $2 billion to build some of these stadiums that are going up. You know, it's a great thing to keep that building state-of-the-art because, I mean, it is a major economic driver in New Orleans and in the southern part of the state. You know, if a major event comes to New Orleans, it's just not to New Orleans. You know, Baton Rouge feels the effects and the Gulf Coast does. So anything they can do to keep that building in line to host, you know, national championship games in football, which is coming up, to be in the rotation for the Super Bowl, which is ultimately important, to be in that rotation for Final Fours. You know, if you poll the national media and other, you know, other entities, they'll tell you there's no better place to have a major championship event than New Orleans because the Superdome's a great building. Everything's within walking distance. You don't have to worry about the public transportation needs because you can walk to it. And let's face it, you know, say the Saints decide they ever did want to replace the Superdome, where are you going to put it? And if you say, well, we'll put it at the side of the Superdome, well, where are the Saints going to play? I mean, there are not many other options other than to keep the building, you know, state of the art. So, you know, I salute them. I've got no issue with that.
John, appreciate you coming on, as always, making time for us. And great insight, as always, my friend. And I hope you have enjoy the rest of your week.
Same to you, Ray. Have a good one.
It's John Marques, senior columnist for the Town Talk and thetowntalk.com, breaking down his latest column that LSU should go ahead and part ways with Will Wade now rather than wait. And his insight on the Superdome renovation project. We'll wrap up the first hour of RP3 and Company right here on 103.7 The Game after this. Welcome back to RP3 and Company here on 103.7 The Game. Broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. Simulcast on KXKW, Channel 32.1 Stadium Network. 24 hours of sports coverage. So, we know that this show, or that this tag team duo of Raymond Parsh III and Cody Schutz, we were on the American Alliance of Football train.
I mean, in fairness, I mean, I'm on the XFL train. I've been riding that XFL train since the week before the AAF was even announced. But I was about the Memphis Express.
That's right.
I'll say that.
You were repping the Express.
I was about the Memphis Express.
That's right. The worst team in the AAF. So was I. We repped the Memphis Express.
What is like the worst team in a league that didn't make it? You know what? I'll say this, though. I don't remember the worst team in the original run of the XFL. I will forever remember the worst team in the original run of the Alliance. So, there's that.
Congratulations. Congratulations.
I wonder if FedEx is happy to have that affiliation.
Oh. So, you know, after 8 weeks, they fold, right? They can't pay their bills. They just fold up shop. Guys don't even can't even go get their own stuff. They go back to their hotel that they're staying at, players are. Their stuff's on the curb. People are in the middle of getting treatments. All of a sudden, it stops. Oh, you have a torn ACL? Ooh. See ya.
That's going to be tough. Here's a referral.
Go to the clinic down the street. So, reports came out yesterday that AAF investor, one of the original investors of the league, Reggie Fowler, has been arrested on bank fraud charges after a $25 million investment. Fowler was arrested on Tuesday with charges of bank fraud and operating an unlicensed money transmitting business. That sounds awesome. That's a guy that I want to start up a football league. He was a former minority stakeholder in the Minnesota Vikings. Fowler invested nearly $25 million in the AAF during its inaugural season, but withdrawals from his domestic and foreign accounts were reportedly, quote, held up around Christmas before the league even started, freezing a key source of the league's funding. So now we know why they had to get someone else to help them with payroll, because the cat who was supposed to be taking care of payroll, an investor, had, quote, his domestic and foreign accounts were reportedly held up around Christmas. The Alliance of American Football is currently sorting through a myriad of financial troubles after the league folded last month, including filing for Chapter 7 bankruptcy. The league has claimed assets of $11.3 million and liabilities of $48.3 million, holding just a $500,000 and some change in cash. The decision to fold the league in early April sent the league's players into a sea of economic uncertainty. Former Giant safety Adrian Robinson has reported a $2,500 hotel room charge on the league's behalf, while injured players didn't know who would provide medical care. Quote, as word of the crash came down on April 2nd, players scrambled to book their own flights home. Others, some of whom had literally crammed their kids' cribs into hotel rooms, searched for places to stay, Sports Illustrated reported. In the mayhem, one Arizona Hotshots player texted a friend on the Memphis Express to ask if he was okay. The reply, quote, this feels like the Fry Festival. Woof. Woof. You, one of your initial investors, all of a sudden has his, quote unquote, withdrawals from domestic and foreign accounts were reportedly held up around Christmas. You weren't even playing a game yet. It really does feel like Ebersol was hoodwinked here, Cody, doesn't it?
I mean, somebody was. Could it be that it falls back on this one guy? You really think that's where, or maybe?
Well, he's a partial investor.
It's the
but if you have so many investors and you're counting on one cat to bring $25 million to the table,
right?
And all of a sudden, his checks aren't going through before the league even starts.
Right. I mean, if not all on this guy, he seems to be maybe the guy at the top of the mountain that started the snowball. It got to the bottom, it was too much.
This is just the beginning. And this cat tried to buy the Vikings in 2005. If you're the Minnesota Vikings, you're like, yeah, well, we're good. We're good. We're good. He tried to buy the Vikings in 05. Reporters looked into his business then. Quote, officials at the company have not returned telephone calls. Its main office is in a strip mall. That's it for the first hour of RP3 and Company. Interview with Caleb Clark, STM, coming up next here on 103.7 The Game.
It may not be stomach issues.
For me, it's intense gas.
Live and local on Acadiana's number one sports station, 103.7 The Game. It's time for RP3 and Company, where Raymond Parks III and Cody Schutz talk sports with the biggest names in the state of Louisiana. Pro Football Hall of Famer Ricky Jackson.
I tell you what, man, I was out playing basketball, and a lot of guys came and told me, thanks, draft or two, and they're looking for you. I had to tell y'all all about the draft.
UFC superstar Dustin the Diamond Poirier.
It means everything to me. You know, Lafayette, Louisiana, I was born and raised. I'm a Cajun. I love it. I can't wait to walk to the airport with that belt.
Time to find out what's behind that door as RP3 and Company starts now.
Welcome back to RP3 and Company here on 103.7 The Game. I'm your host, Raymond Parch III, and it's time for us to head out to the ARCO Equipment Hotline as we welcome on our next guest. He is the defending Louisiana Bass Nation 2018 Junior Bassmaster State Champion from STM, Caleb Clark. Caleb, how are you this morning, brother?
I'm good, and yourself?
Doing well, Caleb. Look, I wanted to talk to you. I appreciate you making some time for us, because I know you're gearing up for the state championships this weekend down there in Berwick at the Berwick Landing in Morgan City. Let's start there. What's your mindset right now heading into the state championships here for your senior season with the STM fishing team?
Going into it, I'm just hoping that me and my partner can do as well as we plan. We hope to make it back to nationals, which would mean placing either first or second again. Haven't fished there at all, but we're going to put in a week of practice and see what we can get out of it.
Caleb, what can you lean on, if anything? I know it's a different venue. You guys fished at Toledo Bend last year for the state championship, but what can that experience, what can you kind of learn from that experience being able to win the state championship last year that maybe you can use this weekend?
Basically, every cast and every bite will count, because, I mean, last year we caught one fish, and that's what really won us the tournament. I mean, we had four others, but that one fish pushed us over the top.
You know, you said that one fish. Walk me back through that. You said that one fish. Was it on the last day of the competition, that final fish that you guys were able to reel in that helped you win the state championship?
Yes, sir. It was actually it was an 8-pounder that we had caught around 10:30 that morning, and it was the last fish that we had caught actually the whole day. But we had caught our limit early in the morning, and then after we had caught our limit, we just went out deep and caught one big one.
You know, for you, Caleb, you were part of this team where you guys didn't even have a team, right? Your freshman year in high school there at STM, there was no bass fishing club or team. You guys created one, had it there as a sophomore. As a junior, you win a state championship, and now you guys are headed back to the state championships once again. Talk about how much pride you take in the fact that you were part of something, the foundation of a great bass fishing program here in Acadiana.
You know, I mean, all of my friends and I are very proud to be a part of, because we all kind of got together and saw that other schools had had a team, not necessarily just in Lafayette, but in other states and around the area. And we wanted to do the same thing in tournament fishing. So, you know, I mean, just being able to help the school, I guess you could say, is the best part. Because, I mean, I've even talked to our moderator that probably next year, whenever I don't have college tournaments, I plan on captaining those that either don't have a boat or don't have a captain, in order for them to be able to fish and experience the tournaments that we did.
So it's kind of your way of making sure to give back to the future championship fishermen that are going to come through STM.
Yeah, yes, sir.
Well, that's outstanding, man. Outstanding the way you're giving back there. I want to get your thoughts on, you know, the during its annual executive committee spring meeting just last month, the Louisiana High School Athletic Association approved bass fishing as an official sport on a one-year trial basis, but most people believe that it's going to catch on after that and it will become a permanent winter sport for the state. When you heard that news and found that out, just what was your reaction to that, man?
I mean, I'm both, like, happy about it, and just I'd like to see how it turns out, because I don't know how LHSAA is either going to partner with BSS or start their whole new division. Being so new to the sport, I guess you could say, it could end up very well, or it could end up to where they neither run a few more trials on it.
So you anticipate there could possibly be some growing pains with everything coming together?
Yeah, I'm confused on the formatting of how they're going to do their tournaments, like as far as, you know, the state championship goes and how for football it has, you know, divisions and stuff like that. It's just, I'd like to see how they organize the tournaments and how you make it to the state championship and everything like that.
We're talking to Caleb Clark, STM senior and defending state champion in bass fishing. Caleb, let's talk a little bit about, I know your preferred fishing spot where you spend countless hours on end is Lake Martin. Why did you fall in love with Lake Martin, and why is that one of your favorite fishing spots?
Lake Martin's just the closest to where I live, honestly. I mean, we have a bunch of other waters, such as like the Basin and Henderson. And we fish there probably just as much, but as far as being close and able to get there right after school, I just prefer going to Lake Martin.
Tell me a little bit about your decision, Caleb. I know you've already expressed that you're going to be attending the University of Louisiana at Lafayette right here locally and going to be taking part in their bass fishing team. What brought you to that decision to stay closer to home and to be part of their team on the collegiate level?
You know, I've always liked the school. It was you could say it wasn't that big of a decision. I kind of knew that I was going to go to UL ever since the beginning. I don't know, it's just, didn't really feel like leaving. You know, I get to stay home, stay with the family, and then work on fishing and school.
Let's talk a little bit about family, Caleb. I don't know, you know, a lot of people may not know this, but your grandfather is in the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame. I know your grandfather a little bit. He's the legendary Jack Haynes, the first man from the state of Louisiana to win the Bassmaster Classic, the Super Bowl of bass fishing. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with your grandfather and what you have learned from him over the years when you're out on the water.
My grandpa and I are very close, along with my uncle. I mean, we fish every weekend, if not during the week also together. Basically, he's just, ever since I was little, always taught me what to do and how to do it correctly. Going into high school, I mean, he helped me get more serious into the sport of fishing, because you can go out there and just go through the motions just like any other sport, or you can really focus and get what you need to get done to get better.
I'm going to assume, Caleb, that that your grandfather, Jack, he taught you all about patience when you're out on the water, right? Because you can spend days out there and not get anything, and then you can be out there for 15 minutes and hauling in bass after bass. Did he teach you about patience while you're out on the water, man?
Yeah, it's a very stressful sport. I mean, just tournament fishing itself. Fun fishing is a completely different story. You go out on the water and you don't have to worry about catching fish. I mean, that's what you're trying to do, but you don't have to catch five that are better than everyone else's. I mean, you're relaxed out there. Whenever you get into a tournament situation, you start feeling the pressure as time winds down, and you knowing what you need to do in order to catch those five fish or more than five to help you win that tournament.
Caleb, what did it mean to you for last year when you and your teammate earned a spot in the Mossy Oak Fishing Bassmaster High School Series National Championship there at Kentucky Lake in Paris, Tennessee, and the man who was driving the boat for you at Nationals was none other than your own grandfather. What did that mean to you, and what was that experience like to be able to share that with your grandfather?
It was like an experience I've never had before. Just from the tournament, from the state championship getting us to Nationals, being that it was all such a surprise, going into weigh-in, we didn't think we had it, and beating the team under us by less than 2 ounces, it seemed like it was all in the plan.
And was your grandfather there for that as well, driving the boat for the state tournament?
Yes, sir, he was. Actually, the moment before I caught it was a 7-7-1 that helped us win the tournament. The moment before, he had looked at me and my partner, and we weren't focusing like we should have. And he looked at us, and he was just like, "All right, boys, y'all need to do what y'all need to do and focus." And not but a minute later, I hooked into that 8-pounder.
And what was going through your mind with your teammate on the boat with you and your grandfather in the boat with you, and you reeled in that 8-pounder? What was going through your mind in that moment, man?
As long as we got in the boat, whenever I hooked it, I was very nervous. But as soon as we got in the boat, it was just nothing but joy.
I can imagine. We're speaking to Caleb Clark. He's an STM senior and the defending state champion in bass fishing. State championships for this year will be this weekend down in Morgan City. Caleb, did you know growing up, because I know your grandfather a little bit, he's a very humble man. He does not like to have a lot of shine on himself. He doesn't like to be in the spotlight, so to speak. And I know interviewing him in the past, he's that way. He's very humble. Did you know how big of a deal your grandfather was in bass fishing circles growing up? Or when was the moment when you figured out, hey, my grandfather's kind of a big deal to people?
I always knew. I mean, and I was always so proud of, you know, being able to have a grandpa that did everything and is able to teach me everything that I've learned. But I can always remember one tournament we pulled up, and one of our tournament directors, I'm driving the truck about to put my grandpa's boat into the water, and I hear the tournament director say, "That's Jack Haynes." And it was just kind of made me smile a little bit more than anything else.
Caleb, let's talk about this season. How have you fared out on the water, and how much confidence do you have going into the state championships this weekend?
Throughout the season, we haven't done as great as we planned. We haven't won any tournaments, so we came in 7th in Bayou Signet, which was, we kind of put it all together, my partner and I, just by going out there and finding an area that we had caught them pretty well, and we ended up where we should have been in the top 10. And going into this weekend in Morgan City, we just have to really put our heads down and figure out what we need to do to catch the right fish in order to bring us to the nationals in the summer.
Caleb, we'll wrap it up with this. You know, what's your game plan regardless of what happens? Obviously, if you win state or finish in the top two, you earn a spot at nationals, and that's the goal this weekend. But if that doesn't happen, what's your game plan for the summer? Are you going to be spending it all your time out on the lake? Or what's your game plan regardless of what happens this weekend?
Regardless of what happens, I plan on fishing more than half this summer, especially improving some skills in deeper water and stuff like that in order to catch bigger fish. But just getting ready for college and everything like that, I would say mainly just if we don't win, we're still going to have a good time being there and definitely improving on going into the future.
Well, Caleb, I appreciate you making some time for us here at 103.7 The Game. Wish you and the rest of the STM fishing team all the best of luck this weekend in Morgan City, and we'll talk to you soon.
You too. Thank you.
That's Caleb Clark, STM senior bass fisherman and defending state champion. They're gearing up for this weekend down in Morgan City for this year's state championships. It's going to be held at Berwick Landing. We got to go to a break. More RP3 and Company after this on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company. I am your host, Raymond Parks III, here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. Simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1 Stadium Sports Network. Well, this series has been up and down for the Houston Astros on the road. They're playing at Target Field in a 4-game set with the Minnesota Twins. They dropped game one, which was a pitcher's duel. Verlander only gave up one run. They lost 1-0. Then their bats explode
nearly beat him by a football score in game two. And then last night, they drop another game 6-2 against the Twins. What you heard there was Jonathan Scoop's two-run blast off of Houston Astros starting pitcher Colin McHugh there in the third inning. Not only did McHugh get roughed up a little bit, he's now 3-for-3 on the year. He allowed 4 runs on just 5 hits and a walk in just 6 innings of work. Scoop's home run started the scoring off of McHugh with a 2-run blast, like I said, in the third. Jorge Polanco added an RBI single in the inning as well. And then Nelson Cruz capped the scoring off of McHugh with an RBI single in the sixth. And then they added an RBI double in the 2-run 8th inning, the Twins did. A couple insurance runs there. Martin Perez, though, Minnesota's lefty, just shut down Houston's all right-handed lineup last night. Perez is now 4-0 on the year. He's won his third consecutive start. He held the Astros to only 4 hits and 2 walks over 8 scoreless innings before the Astros scored a pair of runs off of Trevor Hildenberger in the 9th. I'm not for sure if that's how he pronounces his name, but I just felt it was such a strong, aggressive name. The German in me was like, Hildenberger.
Sounds like a name the Pink Panther would come up with when he's like put on the spot. Like, what's your
just
name?
Just a made up name.
My name is Chesterton Hildenberger.
Hildenberger. Astros shortstop Carlos Correa did extend his hitting streak to 13 games with a double in the 9th. Diaz and White added RBI singles. So it's hard to tell about this Astros team. It's still early in the season, obviously. They play again today at 12:10. Right here on 103.7 The Game. That's right. We're going to take care of you for your Astros. Okay? 4th game of this 4-game series at the Twinkies. Astros, Twins. First pitch is going to be at 12:10. So we're going to interrupt Jim Rome. We're going to go out to Astros for you guys. And then Bumper to Bumper Sports will pick things up at 4 o'clock. Live from the tap room in River Ranch. Now, if the Astros get done a little bit early, you'll get a little Jordy Holberg show today. If not, then you'll just have to tune in with Uncle Jordy tomorrow. But Astros will take care of you today at 12:10, first pitch, as they try to even the series and at least get a split. We'll talk more about the Astros and the kind of the up and down nature so far for them this season. They're not dominant. They're not consistently dominant. When they're great, they're the best team in baseball. But they're having these lulls where they are, let's be honest, they've played mediocre. When Verlander is lights out as he was the other day, they can't buy a hit. When they do get hits, sometimes then the pitching is off. They haven't been able to consistently put it together. They're still, around the top there for the AL West. It's still early. It's only May. But we'll get to that with James Yasko, our next guest.
The Astros are actually, they're in first place right now.
They're still in first place.
They're one game in first place because the Mariners are 3-7 in their last 10 games.
Remember those April champions?
So yeah, so the Seattle Mariners. The Astros, even though the Astros are 5-5 in their last 10, which is not great at all, but Mariners helping us out, or the Astros out there with a 3-7 in the last 10 games. As far as overall records go in the American League, in the win column, the Astros are only one game behind the win total leader. That would be the Tampa Bay Rays. Have 19 wins.
Who won the opening series against them there in Tampa against the Astros.
So they have the most wins in the American League with 19, but the Astros, again, have 18 wins. So they're only one behind in the win column.
Once again, early May, right? They'll get into a rhythm here. But I am surprised of the lack of consistency from the Astros. Is there any concern whatsoever? Not really. I mean, this isn't like a Yankee situation or a Red Sox situation, okay? The Astros will figure it out. They have a veteran manager. They have a great core of Bregman and Altuve and Carrera. They just have to get more consistent. And if that happens, and they can stay healthy, there's not a team in baseball that can beat them. But last year, remember, it was the injuries. They got nicked up too much. Altuve, Carrera, those guys got nicked up down the stretch, and they weren't exactly 100% come playoff time. And it cost them. This year, the injuries haven't played as much of a role, but the lack of consistent performance, just in a series. Like, we have yet to see that, with the exception of that Yankee series and the Seattle Mariners series that were back-to-back, if I remember right, where they swept the Yankees there at Minute Maid and then went on the road and took care of the April champions, the Seattle Mariners. They haven't had any real consistency in a series since then. So we'll see if they can kind of close it out, at least get a split today against the Twins. Once again, you can listen to that game live right here on 103.7 The Game. First pitch, 12:10 today. We'll talk more about the Stros up and down season so far with our next guest, James Yasko of the Lima Time Time podcast, right here.
I want to get, well, before we hit the break, I got to give a shout out to my Cubbies, though. The Cubbies there. The Cardinals in the National League, there are three teams that have already reached the 20-win mark. The Cardinals being one of them. The Cardinals are 9-1 in their last 10 games. But the Cubbies are on the come up. They're only three games back now, making a push to get back to the top of that division. So I was worried for a while.
My Braves are not there.
It's okay. It's early.
They are struggling. No bullpen. Come on. Go get a pitcher.
Can't have that in the majors. No, that's a no. No, no.
Improve the bullpen. You got probably the best young like player under the age of 23 on your roster. Get it together. And go sign another starting pitcher. I'm all fired up. Damn you bringing your Cubs into it. I'm all fired up. We'll talk more Stros next here on RP3 and Company on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company. I'm your host, Raymond Parse III, here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting, as always, from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. Simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1 Stadium Sports Network. It's time now for us to head out to the ARCO Equipment Hotline. He is the co-host of Lima Time Time Podcasts, your number one source for all things Astros on the podcast. It's our good friend, James Yasko. James, how are you this morning?
Hey, I'm all right. How are you doing?
Doing well, doing well. So, let's get right to it, James. It's early. When this team is on, the Houston Astros, there's no better team in baseball. When that lineup is geared up and ready to go and the pitching is there, there's not a better team in all of Major League Baseball. The problem, correct, it seems like so far, is that they just have not been able to play consistently as a unit for an entire series, with the exception of the sweep of the Yankees at home there at Minute Maid, and then what they did to the Seattle Mariners. With the exception of that, they've still been very up and down. It seems that they just haven't maybe gelled as a complete team, despite being in first place in the AL West. Your thoughts?
I think that's right. I mean, and I don't, there's a couple of things that we can sort of take away, is that, you know, I don't want to run the risk of overreacting. That's not true. I do. But, you know, the Colin McHugh may end up being better suited in the bullpen. He did pretty well, except for the home run he gave up to Scope last night that landed in Canada. But it's just not quite there the same way that it was. Granted, you know, it's an outdoor stadium in Minnesota, so which is one of the dumbest ideas in baseball history. So it's cold. There's like 18 people in the stands, and there's a lot sort of behind the inconsistency. But it's also worth noting that there's not a team in the majors who has played more games against over 500 teams than the Astros. I think last night was the 26th out of their 31 games that they've played against a team that is over 500. And seeing as how, you know, there's only, other than the Astros, there's like four teams over 500 in the American League. They've had a pretty tough schedule to begin the year. Once the cupcake section starts hitting, then I think things will be a little bit more right in the world.
We're talking to James Yasko of the Lima Time podcast. What'd you think about Gerrit Cole and how he's pitched so far this season? I've been impressed. I think he's going to be a very strong number two for this staff. Your thoughts on Gerrit and what you've seen so far?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems like that one start against the Rangers was an anomaly, which that's great and not sort of a portent of doom that maybe instant reaction would have been. He would be the ace of how many teams? How many other teams? 20, 24, 25 teams?
Yeah.
And so to have him and Verlander making up 40% of your start, you've got to feel pretty good about that.
So if it's not Colin that you feel can be the number three for this staff and you think he's more inclined and better suited for the Astros bullpen, who is on staff right now that you feel could rise up to be the number three guy in the rotation, James?
I mean, the plan at the beginning of the year was to have Josh James. I think, you know, he had a pretty strong case to making the rotation going into spring training. He had that quad injury that set him back, and he's had some mechanics, and maybe his back's hurting a little bit. It could be Josh James, but it could also be, you know, a Forrest Whitley or, you know, maybe it's a Corbin Martin. I don't know. I try not to have prospect attachment syndrome. And Colin McHugh has certainly proven more at the big league level than either of those dudes have. I'm not saying that McHugh needs to go to the bullpen, but, you know, it's not a terrible option to have. I mean, you look at his stats last year, he was ridiculous in the bullpen. And so to have him back there, provided that there's someone else that's just ready, it's not a bad thing for this team.
James, do you feel if that does happen and let's say they decide to make the move to McHugh, you still don't believe that the Stros would try to make some type of move in between now and the trade deadline and bring in a veteran arm like they've done in the past?
I certainly think they could. You know, I think that, you know, obviously it's not – the Astros are not a team whose window is closing. But, you know, every year that goes by that you don't win the World Series, you wonder if you didn't miss a pretty significant opportunity. And so the Astros have an incredibly deep farm system, and Luno has shown that he has the ability and the willingness to make those trades to strengthen the roster. So I don't think all of their options – I don't think their options are limited to internal options. I think if there's the right deal that comes out, whether that's Marcus Stroman, whether that's just re-signing Keuchel, you know, I think that – the front office has shown that they'll do whatever they can to get this team in position.
Besides another starting pitcher, whether that's someone that emerges through the farm system or on the roster or at the trade deadline or possibly a free agent like Dallas Keuchel, what do you see? Is there anything else that you'd like to see the Astros do? I know it's early, but is there anything that you could see maybe down the road that could help solidify this team? The lineup is a murderer's row. But is there anything else, maybe another position player out there that they could use some depth at, so to speak?
I know AJ Hinch has used the DH as sort of a stopgap. It's sort of a half measure of getting guys some rest. And I think he's used 10 different DHs so far this season. And so, you know, I don't think they're going to be in the mood to go out and get, you know, like a Jose Bautista type of, you know, the guy that's just old but still has some pop. But I could see if Tyler White continues, and Tyler White has shown, like, in limited stretches, he has shown that he can hit major league pitching. It comes and goes, but I could see that if he continues to struggle, or go through extended periods where he's just not hitting the ball. I think DH or another bat is certainly on the table.
Talking to James Yasko, co-host of the Lima Time Time podcast, all things Astros. James, Jose Altuve is the heart of this team. He's a former league MVP, a leader. Any concern whatsoever that he's only batting 256?
No. I think we're more surprised that if you said he was hitting 356, like, oh, yeah, he can do that. That makes sense. So that he's hitting 256 at this point, I don't think it's really it's not a concern. He gets hot. He's not really a streaky hitter. He's always been kind of a consistent hitter. Consistently, he'll get, one to two. He'll get you 10 hits a week. But at this point, no, I'm not concerned. He is coming off that knee surgery. And, as much as the Astros have done in the sort of analytics, other teams are starting to catch up. And so what Altuve has to do is make adjustments to the adjustments that he's making, that the league is making. So he's shown that he can do that fairly well in the past. And I think if there's a hole in his swing, or if he's off with his elbow by a fraction of an inch, then he'll get it fixed.
Yeah, because it is you would expect a guy, a veteran like him, to be able to turn it around. It's just, but you're not that concerned that he's batting under 300, a lot under 300 for the first time in his career since 2013 when he batted 283 on the year.
Yeah, no, I don't. No, I'm not. I mean, he's shown that he's more of a 330 hitter than he is a two. He's been a 330 hitter longer than he's been a 256 hitter. So, you can excuse, and he can get hot for a couple of weeks, and suddenly you look up and he's back hitting 310. He can get hits in bunches. So, after a month or 5 weeks or whatever, there's still a lot of baseball to be played. Now, if we're having this conversation in August, then maybe there's a little bit of a concern.
And what kind of offsets maybe Altuve's minor struggles at the plate has been the way that Michael Brantley has just been tearing it up. How surprised are you of how well he's played this year for the Stros? He's batting 331. He's already got 18 RBIs. I mean, this guy has really been a great pickup for the Stros. Are you surprised how well he's been playing?
No, his entire career has been durability. So the fact that he's putting it together while he's healthy, that's not surprising at all. I think the thing that's most surprising, or the thing that should be the most surprising, is that other teams didn't offer him a bigger deal. And so I guess there were, league-wide questions about how healthy he can be over the course of a season. But he's doing exactly what the Astros expected him to do, and the goal is just keep him on the field as long as he can.
James, I want to get your thoughts. George Springer, Springer Dinger himself, has been disciplined by Major League Baseball for the inappropriate language directed at Angel Hernandez. Your thoughts on that and the punishment that came along with it?
I mean, we learned in Bull Durham that's the one word that's going to get you rung up. So it's not like culture has shifted that much. It's not surprising, when I saw the GIF the replay of what he said, I thought, ooh, I bet that's in the way that society is sort of structured. I thought like that's probably going to lead to some backlash. I guess I'm just more surprised that it took as long as it did. So not terribly surprised, but again, like Bull Durham taught us, like you don't say that to an umpire. I think it'd be okay to eliminate that word from anybody's vocabulary, but it's not the most surprising thing.
Yeah. And, Major League Baseball released a statement, this inappropriate behavior was addressed with Mr. Springer and the Houston Astros, and he has been disciplined. They did not disclose the specifics regarding his punishment. James, Twins are a pretty good ball club, right? So I think we can admit to that. I don't think they're the kind of paper April champions that Seattle is. I think the Twins have some good pieces. They're going to be scrappy, and they're going to be a team that's going to give a lot of teams trouble this season, I think. I don't think they're going to be a playoff team, but I think you're going to see the Twins give teams problems. What is it about what Minnesota does that's been giving Houston so many issues here so far this season?
I think that, you know, one thing that Odorizzi did the other night when he just completely shut down the Astros is that the issue when you play your two season series basically from 1 week to next, the Twins have a pretty smart office, and they're into the analytical side. That again, I think the gap is closing as far as front offices and analytics with the Astros. So I don't know that what they're doing is shocking, or they're totally changing up their game plan, but they're playing really smart baseball. And I actually think they could be a playoff team. With Kluber breaking his forearm, you know, obviously you've got Bauer and Carrasco, but that's a weak division sort of, you know, from third, but it's going to be a 1-2 battle between Minnesota and Cleveland all year. But I think the Twins could make the playoffs. And, you know, one thing that they do that hurts the Astros is they play in a freaking outdoor stadium in freaking Minnesota, and it's 21 degrees and you've got polar bears in the outfield. And that's pretty effective, I think, for baseball players.
And it circles back to James's disdain for Target Field. Does that disdain only apply to the field itself, or does it also apply to the national chain, James?
I'm okay with Target. It's all right. It's as a brand, I guess. I've been to Minneapolis, and I went to the Metrodome, so I haven't been to Target Field. But Minneapolis is a very nice city, and I'm assuming that St. Paul is as well. But I used to live in upstate New York, and summer in the north is absolutely fantastic. It's the other 49 weeks out of the year that freaking suck.
49 weeks.
It's just cold all the time. You want to have an outdoor stadium, that's fine. But realize your geography, and it could be that in 50 years the climate change has gotten so bad that it's going to look like a really smart decision, and it's just going to be 90 degrees all the time in Minneapolis. Well, it's going to be 170 here in Texas. But at least acknowledge that, you know, a retractable roof, it doesn't cost that much more. I mean, at some point you're just playing with Monopoly money, so if it's going to cost you $400 million, go ahead and spend the extra 60 on a roof that can close when it's 39 degrees outside.
James, appreciate your time as always, my friend. Enjoy the week and enjoy today's some day baseball. And we'll talk to you soon.
Hey, sounds good. Thanks,
James Yasko. So what we learned about James today, he thinks that the Astros will be fine, that someone will emerge as a pitcher, that they could make a deal at the trade deadline. Not to worry about Jose Altuve struggling at the plate to start off the season, and that you have no business having an outdoor stadium if you're in Minnesota or the northern part of the United States. That's next level stuff right there. We want to thank James from the Lima Time podcast. When we come back here on RP3 and Company, did hip-hop superstar Drake, did he give his curse to a Game of Thrones character?
Oh, no, he didn't.
Oh, we'll dive right in, right here on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company here on 103.7 The Game.
To fight the urge to rap over that.
Oh, the Drake curse, the dreaded Drake curse has surpassed the Madden curse. The SI cover curse in all of sports media. Drake is the ultimate bandwagoner. So anytime a team is good, he will jump on, he will rep their gear, a hat or a jersey, and then promptly after posting it on social media, that team will then get stomped. Every time. You can count on it. It's become a thing in sports media. So much so that an Italian soccer club has banned players from even talking about Drake or doing it. Most recently, the Toronto native showed up for Game 4 of the NHL playoffs between the Maple Leafs and Bruins wearing a Leafs jersey, only to watch the Bruins topple his beloved team. Italian soccer team AS Roma even jokingly banned its players from taking photos with the rapper during the season. People believe the Drake curse is real. Why do I bring this up? Because now the Drake curse is seemingly is going to be going, transferring from the world of sports to the world of fictional shows about dragons and sex.
Fictional shows based on fictional books.
And dwarves and sword fights.
Are there dwarves in?
Yes.
There are.
Shout out to Arya Stark for putting in that work last week. Hey.
That's right.
I know not what he's referencing, but
apparently Drake is a huge GOT fan. GOT? Yeah, there we go.
Because we watched the show.
No, we do not. We do not. Game of Thrones fans. And he gave a shout out to the character. This was during after receiving the top Billboard 200 album award for his album Scorpion on Wednesday night at the Billboard Music Awards. He thanked his family, his friends, and contributors, and then right before he left stage, he gave an unexpected shout-out to the character of Arya Stark, who apparently had herself a hell of an episode on Game of Thrones the other day. Not to spoil it for anyone, okay?
Yeah, this is my knowledge of Game of Thrones right here. It's the entrance theme.
Nice.
That's all I got.
Nice.
That's all I got for you.
When I found out what happened to Sean Bean, I checked out. That's my guy. And I was like, what? I'm not. So I will get around to watching Game of Thrones, but I don't like being pressured because everyone's like, it's the greatest show on television. And when you start telling me that, I check out, bro. I'm done.
I did see a clip online somewhere. It was somebody kind of turned it into like a meme, so to speak. And it was of the chick that has the dragons that she walks around with.
Yes.
And like she's pretending to give one of the dragons to another guy that I guess also wants the throne or something as part of his deal. And so he, like, takes the dragon from her, and, like, she gets what she wants, and then the other guy that got the dragon calls her the B word. She gets real angry, says some stuff in a language I don't understand, and the dragon promptly melted old boy to the ground. And this was, like, an adolescent-sized dragon. It was, like, the size of a person. It wasn't even a huge, like,
there's a lot of stuff going on in Game of Thrones. People tell me it's amazing. I'll get around to watching it after everyone is done tripping over themselves to tell me how great it is.
It's never a good day for a red wedding.
Oh, nice, nice, nice. See, we do know, we don't watch the show, but we do know stuff.
I know the memes.
we know the memes. So, but will the Drake curse now seep over to Game of Thrones? It's the final season. The Stark character, she had herself an MVP moment on the last episode. Will that now spell doom for her? Oh.
Probably.
Probably so. We'll have to stay tuned. Second hour is in the books. We got Drake and Game of Thrones up in this show today. That takes talent, my friend. Third hour coming up, our good friend Les East of CrescentCitySports.com. He's going to talk Pels, Saints with us after this break right here on 103.7 The Game.
Live and local, we are Acadiana Sports Station, 103.7 The Game, KLWB, Karen Crow, Lafayette. It's time for RP3 and Company, where Raymond Parch III and Cody Schutz talk sports with the biggest names in the state of Louisiana. LSU All-American Skylar Green.
You know, as a young athlete growing up, you always want to do the game-winning something, the game-winning shot, game-winning catch. And I thought the biggest part for me right there, that Georgia catch, that solidified everybody seeing that LSU for real.
Ridge and Cajun hoop star Alfred Payton.
But it's definitely a boost when you know, when you look up in the stadium and you see your mom, see your dad, night in and night out, it's just different. I encourage everybody to be an opportunity to play at home, to do it. It's very fulfilling.
Time to find out what's behind that door as RP3 and Company starts now.
Welcome to the third and final hour of RP3 and Company here on 103.7 The Game. I'm your host, Raymond Parch III, and we're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. We're also simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1. We led off today's show talking about the New Orleans Saints doing the extension for 10 years to remain at the Superdome. I sometimes still call it the Louisiana Superdome. It is, in fact, sponsored. It's the Mercedes-Benz Superdome. Also, the $450 million renovation project that's supposed to be taking 4 years to make the Superdome as state-of-the-art as possible to continue allowing it to be one of the great destinations for Final Fours, WrestleManias, Super Bowls, and other marquee events. We're going to talk a little bit more about that project and about that news that broke yesterday with our next guest. He covers the New Orleans Pelicans and the New Orleans Saints for CrescentCitySports.com. He joins us every Thursday. It's our good friend Les East. Les, how are you this morning, brother?
Doing well, Raymond. How are you?
Doing well, doing well. So I'm going to assume, Les, that you weren't surprised with the extension between the Saints and the Superdome, but were you more surprised about just how detailed this renovation project is for the Superdome and the fact that it has the support of multiple factions within the state, including government and the Saints?
Yeah, a little bit surprised. I didn't sense that that was something that was on the front burner that needed to be done immediately or in over a course of time, but nonetheless something that would be on the front burner this quickly or something that necessarily would be that detailed, but I think it's obviously a good thing. I mean, it was going to have to be done at some point. The Superdome is an architectural marvel. For it to still be as good a building as it is, you know, what is it now, 43 years or so since it opened, and to be a building that can be renovated and still be one of the elite buildings in the NFL and for other projects going forward, I think it is still remarkable. But it was something that needed to be done, and I think sooner rather than later is good. And I am pleasantly surprised that it does seem to have a lot of support. You know, sometimes these deals, any deal benefiting one particular area of the state can run into problems in the legislature, and we'll see if that could still be an issue at some point. But initially it looks like it's not meeting with significant opposition, and that's certainly a good thing if that proves to be the case down the road.
Talking to Les East of CrescentCitySports.com, some of the things that kind of stood out to me, Les, about the renovations, which they say will take in four phases and will be done during the off season for the Saints, which will essentially nullify any type of events occurring there besides the Saints and the Essence Music Festival, is the fact that, you know, they're going to remove the famous ramps. They're going to do a lot of suite upgrades. They're going to have some of that standing room only type of seats that a lot of the newer stadiums and ballparks are implementing. Of the renovations, planned renovations, what stands out to you?
Well, I think the removal of those ramps, you mentioned that they're pretty distinctive and have been a big part of the building from the beginning. I think that stands out a little bit, but the other stuff makes sense. I mean, any new stadium or any renovation to an existing stadium is generally going to be built around creating more suites and other premium seating areas because that's where the big bucks are. That's where the corporations get involved. So I think you would expect that to be part of any project like this. The standing room only, I think, makes sense. That's been utilized to a significant degree in other buildings. I think the Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta is one place that does a lot of that. And I think the Superdome, in order to continue to be a relatively modern stadium despite its age, needs to have most of the current features, and I think that's a fairly significant one that probably can be accomplished fairly easily. So I think that's a significant part of the project as well.
Also found it interesting as part of the phase is that, you know, they'd expand the team store, expand the museum, overhaul that, but also retail suites. Like, they want to utilize that ground floor and start putting in, I guess, restaurants and retails, make it even more kind of high-end, more luxury, I guess, is the thought process there. Do you believe that they're a little too ambitious, though, wanting to have all four phases of this overhaul done and completed before the Superdome hosts the Super Bowl in 2024?
Well, we'll see. I think that's definitely what they should attempt to do. You want to put on your best face for the Super Bowl, especially given what happened the last time it was here with the electrical problem, even though that probably they probably took too much abuse for that. It was just a freak situation. Nonetheless, it was something that does not reflect well on the building or the city. So I think you want to do everything you can to put forward your best face the next time they're here. So if it's at all feasible to get it done in time for the next Super Bowl, I think that's the way you should go. And I think we've seen that when everyone involved in the project is committed to doing it in an efficient timeline, it can get done because of the ability to reopen so quickly after Hurricane Katrina. If they could pull that off, they can pull this off.
We're talking to Les East. He's the New Orleans Saints and New Orleans Pelicans writer for CrescentCitySports.com. Les, let's talk about on the field, or in the draft room, rather. The Saints held pat late last week, did not, in fact, trade up into the first round, but they did wheel and deal on day two. They traded up 14 spots. They got their guy, the center out of Texas A&M. I know they believe that he can start immediately, that he's a plug-and-play guy. My question to you is, with that being said, and he's going to be Max Unger's replacement, they signed Eason from Minnesota, and I know he was injured last year. He's a versatile guard slash center. Does he compete with Andrus Pete for one of the guard spots, or do they have Pete there to back up one of the tackles? How do you think the offensive line, which now has depth, is going to play out here?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's going to be one of the pressing issues in training camp to see how that plays out. I think Nick Easton was signed as insurance with Max Unger's retirement. I think they were looking at him before Unger announced his retirement, but they kind of knew Unger was leaning in that direction. Actually, they didn't sign him until after the retirement announcement, but I think they were already talking to him before the announcement came out. And so I think they were going to sign him no matter what to create depth on the interior of the line. And when Unger retired, it gave them a viable option to replace Unger if it came to that. But I don't think that was their intention that when they signed Easton that he was going to replace Unger. I think it was a fallback position. And now with the drafting of Eric McCoy, it gives them some options with Easton. I think they still have him compete at center coming in because you just don't know if a rookie is going to be ready to play at any position, but especially center, which is a mentally taxing position for a rookie. So I think he comes in, Nick Easton, and competes at center and at guard. I think they know if they need to slide him in at guard at some point, it's an easy transition for him to make, but they're expecting Andrus Pete, at least for the final year of his contract, to probably be the left guard. Easton will compete with McCoy at center. If McCoy wins the job, then Easton is there to back up at all of the interior spots. But, you know, that a lot can happen in training camp and the preseason. They're just getting ready to start the off-season program. So there's a lot that could change, but I think that's kind of the game plan is Easton and McCoy will compete at center, and Easton's going to give them a lot of versatility and depth regardless of how the starting positions play out.
And it could also – Easton could also be their guy moving forward if they decide not to bring back Andrus Pete, right, after this season.
Yeah, I think that's part of the equation as well. I think the expectation is that Pete's a solid starter as long as he's here. But once his contract expires, the business decision may or may not enable him to be here beyond next season, and Easton gives him insurance in that regard as well.
Les, what did you think of the rest of their draft. They got a nice, versatile kid out of Florida, defensive back. And then later, they got a guy that a lot of people were high on, the Hampton kid out of Rutgers, that played for a bad team. But a lot of people, including Mike Dettelier and other draft experts, had that guy rated far higher than a sixth-round draft pick. What did you think of the Saints' picks, the rest of their picks, after their second-round pick?
Well, I think they did a nice job based on their own evaluation, which has been a pretty good evaluation since Jeff Ireland came on board a few years ago. You know, they entered the draft with one pick in the top 167, and Mickey Loomis said they got three guys in their top 70. And they had to give up a number two next year, obviously, to be able to do that. But nonetheless, that seems like pretty good value if they're – projections can are reasonably accurate. So I think, you know, the one thing that maybe you scratch your head a little bit about would be why they needed to take two safeties with three of their top picks. But, you know, I think they just went with the best player on their board. And I think the top three picks all were generally rated much higher than where the Saints were picking. So I think they did a good job of getting value there. The versatility of both safeties, Gardner Johnson and also the kid from Rutgers, I think both of those guys can play the run, they can play the pass, but going in initially, I think they're primarily going to contribute on special teams, and that's helpful as well. So I think they got good value with those picks. I think all of the one thing you try to avoid with a draft, if you're hoping that a team does well with their picks, is you don't want to have something out of left field where you say, why in the world did they pick that guy? He's not rated that high. It's not a position of need. Or they could have gotten him with a later pick. I don't think any of those questions apply to any of their picks. And in that regard, I think you have to say they did a pretty good job.
Les, your thoughts on the franchise deciding not to pick up the fifth-year option on cornerback Eli Apple, who they traded for last year. He became a very good number two corner for them. Your thoughts on them not picking up the fifth-year option on the former Ohio State Buckeye?
I think they made the right decision. It doesn't mean he won't be here beyond this season, but it makes it, I guess, slightly more likely that he'll go somewhere else since they didn't pick up the option. But, you know, I think the option would have cost them, I don't know, $13 million or so for next year. He has not proven either in New York or in the brief period of time he's been here that he's worth that kind of money. Maybe he will after this season. But I think given what his production has not justified what the option would have cost them. So I think it made sense to go ahead and play out this year, accept the risk of him quite possibly going on the open market and competing to keep him then if you think it's worthwhile, simply because it doesn't make sense to commit that kind of money to him now based on his performance up to this point.
We're talking with Les East of CrescentCitySports.com. He covers the New Orleans Saints and the New Orleans Pelicans. I want to switch over before we let you go, Les, and talk about the Pels. David Griffin makes his first hire. It looked like he was trying to get a GM in there, a guy that he had worked with there that's with the Los Angeles Clippers. That does not happen, but yet he still hits a home run by most people's estimation by getting one of the best longtime trainers in the business to come and be part of the Pels. Your thoughts on David Griffin's first hire, and why do you think it's so important?
Well, I think it's important for a couple of reasons. One, just trainers in general are very important because of the role they play in handling the health of players. And when you have large individuals running up and down hardwood floors for 82 games a year, there's a lot of wear and tear on them in addition to just injuries that are obvious. So it's a very important position in general, but the health of key players and even not key players for the Pelicans over an extended period of time has not been the strength of this organization. Now, that's a very complex issue. There's only so much you can control in terms of players' health, and there's a lot of facets to a medical staff in terms of how you treat injuries and surgeries and stuff like that. So a trainer isn't going to solve all of those issues or guarantee anything about players' health going forward. But overall, the medical staff of the Pelicans has been under scrutiny for a while because so many guys have missed so much time and had injuries that have lingered longer than maybe was expected at the time that they occurred, that I think getting a top-flight person in that position is even more important than it is normally, and trainer is always an important position to begin with.
Les, appreciate you coming on, giving us your insight as always, my friend. Enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks, Raymond.
Les East, CrescentCitySports.com, breaking down the Superdome renovation project, New Orleans Saints draft picks, as well as New Orleans Pelicans making their first hire of the David Griffin era. When we come back, a former LSU Tiger just got himself a promotion. We'll dive into that when we get back right here on RP3 and Company on 103.7 The Game. In Louisiana, there are thousands of miles of utility lines and gas pipelines buried just beneath the surface. Sometimes multiple lines are in one area. So if you or a contractor you hire is digging a hole to put in a new fence, a pool, or just for another reason, you run the risk of hitting an underground line even by digging only a few inches. What happens then? Maybe you only knock the power out for your entire neighborhood. But sometimes there's an explosion with injuries and even death. It happens every year. And there's a very simple way to avoid it. Before you dig, call 811. Call 811 2 days before you dig, tell the operator your address, and someone will come out and mark the location of buried lines so you or your contractor can avoid them. Simple, right? It's free of charge, and it's the law. Louisiana One Call operates 811 as a public service, and to promote public safety, Louisiana One Call and 103.7 The Game remind you, call 811 and know what's below before you dig. Welcome back to RP3 and Company here on 103.7 The Game. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing, also simulcast on KXKW channel.
I don't know what channel is Sneeze. 32.1, I believe, is what you were trying to say.
Thank you. Thank you, Shoots. Thank you. We're a good team.
Was there maybe like a booger or something hung up there making you sneeze? Is that what happened there?
Is that the transition we're going with?
Well, we're forcing it.
Before the break, I told you, LSU former star getting a promotion, and Cody's right. Booger McFarland. Birth name Anthony, nickname Booger, and it just stuck. McFarland will move from his on-the-field analyst position on Monday Night Football to join play-by-play commentator Joe Tessitore in the booth for the 50th season of Monday Night Football. ESPN made the announcement on Wednesday. The two will be joined by sideline reporter Lisa Salters, who returns for her 8th Monday Night Football season, as well as a new officiating analyst, John Perry. McFarland said this in a statement, the former LSU defensive tackle. Quote, I'm so excited to continue to be part of Monday Night Football, especially with the opportunity to be in the booth for the 50th season, working with true professionals and friends like Joe and Lisa. We have a great slate of games, and I look forward to starting our journey in Louisiana, where I was born and raised. That's right, because Monday Night Football starts off inside the Mercedes-Benz Superdome when the New Orleans Saints welcome Deshaun Watson and the Houston Texans. So that's pretty awesome. I'm not going to lie, that's pretty awesome that a Louisiana guy, an LSU guy, is now going to be in the booth.
It's like any time, and I know he's not a Saints guy at all by any means, but it's like any time Terry Bradshaw somehow has something to do with the Saints games, it always it gives it that little something extra.
That's right. I think, look, I like McFarland. I'm disappointed, though. First of all, good things for Monday Night Football. You get a guy who can actually speak on camera and is confident when he speaks on camera. That's great. And now you're going to have him in the booth. Look, Booger knows what he's doing. The guy's whip smart. He's a two-time Super Bowl champion, former star at LSU, played in the NFL a long time. This guy knows what he's talking about. And having him and Tessitore together in the booth will improve that broadcast so much. No offense to Jason Witten, a terrific tight end. He's going to be in Canton for the Hall of Fame. But that guy was, he wasn't awful, he was just mediocre. Okay, he was just average. And if you're the four-letter network, you do not need your product, your flagship product for NFL coverage to be mediocre. You
especially,
need it to be great.
Especially when Tony Romo is over somewhere else doing
on CBS,
a damn
just
good
killing
job.
It.
You know?
Just killing it. What is sad about this news is the fact that we will no longer have the Booger Mobile, that big crane golf cart contraption that they use during the telecast.
You should find another big guy to put on it. It'll be fine.
Just all of a sudden, there's a huge 300-pound man up in.
How's Tony Siragusa back on my TV?
So congratulations to the former Bayou Bengal for getting the much-deserved promotion and being now in the booth for Monday Night Football. When we come back, we'll be talking to Nick Suss of the Clarion Ledger. He's going to give us some Ole Miss baseball preview right here on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 and Company here on 103.7 The Game. I'm your host, Raymond Parch III. We're broadcasting live from the 237 Roof Studios presented by Lafayette Roofing. And we're simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1. That's the Stadium Network, 24 hours of sports coverage. Make sure to check us out on there. Programming reminder, coming up next, the sport of politics. That'll be from 9 to 10. Then it'll be Dan Patrick's show, DP, and the boys from 10 to 11. After that, Jim Rome from 11 to 11:30. That's it. Then Astros pregame is going to take over right here live on 103.7 The Game. First pitch, 12:10. Fourth game of the series for the Astros at the Minnesota Twins there at Target Field in Minneapolis. Once that is completed, the good brother Ben Love will help take you over around 4 o'clock for a full 3 hours of bumper-to-bumper sports today. Also, reminder, all three games of LSU's baseball series against Ole Miss this weekend at Alex Box Stadium can be heard live right here as well on 103.7 The Game Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So make sure to tune in for that. Also, we got you covered for the Kentucky Derby. That's right. On Saturday, pre-race coverage will begin at 4 o'clock. Gate time will be around 5:45 Central. We'll take you up for the running of the Roses, the 145th Kentucky Derby. You can listen to it live right here on 103.7 The Game, courtesy of Westwood One on Saturday. We are efforting our friend Nick Suss once again. Give us some perspective on Ole Miss, who will be taking on mighty LSU this weekend. But what do we know about the Ole Miss baseball team? Cody broke it down the other day for us, saying how good they are at home. They're one of the best teams in the SEC at home. Those two series sweeps over top 10 ranked teams occurred at home there in Oxford. The problem is that they are absolutely dreadful on the road. They're one of the worst, and it reared its ugly head again last night as Ole Miss wrapped up one of its final midweek games at Southern Miss of Conference USA. That's right, Golden Eagles. Ole Miss, number 13 in the country, had won its last five meetings with Southern Miss, but that ended last night at Pete Taylor Park as Southern Miss pulled out the 5-3 win over Ole Miss. Junior shortstop Gray Kessinger paced the Rebels at the plate by going 2-for-5 with a run scored and an RBI, while fellow teammate Houston Roth turned in the Rebels' best outing on the mound, going 2 scoreless innings with just 1 base runner allowed. However, Ole Miss came up short in the back-and-forth affair. Once again, last kind of midweek game, do we read anything into that? No, their overall record's now 30-16. But this goes back to the point of how bad Ole Miss is on the road. They are great at home, but on the road, not so much. They are now 7-9 away from Oxford, 22-6 at home. And this includes their road woes started early in the season. Okay? They started early in the season with a 3-game set at Tulane. Now, they took 2 of 3, but they dropped a game against Tulane where they lost 13-12. Okay? And once again, this is a team that's dominant at home. They lost back-to-back games at then-ranked number 7 Louisville as well back in March. They lost one game in 10 innings, 4-3, and they lost another one 10-8. So against top competition on the road, they struggle. They struggle. They also dropped 2 of 3 at Missouri, who's one of the worst teams in the SEC, losing 2-1, and then losing another game 8-5. They've lost at Arkansas. That's nothing to sneeze at. They're the top-ranked team in the SEC, tied with Vanderbilt atop the standings. But Ole Miss turned around and won the next 2 games to take that series. So they got the series win. And they have some midweek struggles as well, just like LSU, where you scratch your head and you go, how the hell did they lose that game? Did you know that there was a school, Cody, named North Alabama? Were you aware?
No.
Of North Alabama? I'm from Alabama. I didn't know there was a team called North Alabama. Ole Miss found a way to lose to them 10-6 at home. So once again, those midweek struggles that we've talked about on the program, everyone's going through those. It's just not an LSU issue. Just not an LSU issue. As Cody talked to about the other day, even at home they've struggled. They dropped 2 of 3 to that terrible Kentucky team. Lost at home to Kentucky. They went on the road, dropped 2 of 3 at Auburn. Auburn's a decent team. They're ranked in the top 25. But they're not world beaters by any stretch of the imagination. So how's this going to bode well this weekend when they have to come at LSU? Friday night game, 7 o'clock. Saturday game, 6:30. Sunday's rubber match, 2:30.
I guess a story within the story, because those are always fun, right? The game inside the game, or the exactly what I said. I'm not going to repeat myself again. But how cool, or I don't know what the word is, but what are your feelings on the father-son combo that will be in the box this weekend but not wearing the same colored jerseys? Of course, referring to Mike and Drew Bianco.
Correct. One's the head coach at Ole Miss.
Very, very good head coach at Ole Miss. Former LSU Tiger.
Former LSU Tiger. One of Skip's guys. The other one is the son, who's kind of had an up-and-down season.
He's coming on as of late, though.
He's come on of late. This is what we know from reports. They have not seen each other in person since Christmas break.
That's awesome.
Okay. They have not seen each other since Christmas break. They will have a sit-down meal together tonight.
How do we know this again?
It's been reported.
Very nice.
That they're going to have a sit-down meal as a family. But to tell you how much stress this is putting on this family, the mom slash wife.
Right.
Is not coming to the game.
She stayed home.
She's not coming for the weekend series. She's staying at home or is going to be at the hotel because she does not want the camera to constantly be panning onto her to get reaction about her son and then also her husband.
Yeah, did you know, side note, Kramer Robertson, his mom is Kim Mulkey.
Oh, yeah, we haven't heard that.
You didn't know that.
Didn't know that. Take it back even further. Hey, did you know that Fats Domino stayed with Jamarcus Russell during Hurricane Katrina? Because we only heard that about 1.2 million times.
But yeah, the Bianco family, under a bit of stress this weekend, I suppose.
It's going to make things, will dinner be awkward?
Yes, awkward.
It probably won't be, though.
No.
We probably make this bigger of a deal than they are making it, right?
This
they'll probably
dinner
have
be.
Dinner. I bet you they won't talk about this weekend series, though.
No, they'll talk about baseball, I bet.
They'll talk about the season.
But,
hey,
yeah.
How's it going?
Right.
Blah, blah, blah. Well, son, you know, what are you doing? I see that you're doing this. Right. You know, how's school? They'll talk about everything else besides the LSU versus Ole Miss baseball series.
Right.
This weekend.
And this is obvious. As much pressure and as high stress as this weekend series goes, if this isn't the only time LSU and Ole Miss face off this season, this will be the least amount of pressure on any of those games. Because if LSU and Ole Miss match up in a meaningful SEC tournament game, if LSU and Ole Miss match up in a super regional, or God forbid if LSU and Ole Miss somehow match up in Omaha, like that family, that is some turmoil and turbulence to have to go through. Pish posh on a random SEC weekend series when you're playing each other in the super regionals or in Omaha.
Yes. Now, this is a big series for the standings, for the regular season standings, and also to make sure to get that top four seed for the SEC tournament, because if you don't, then you have to play that single elimination round the first day on that Tuesday.
You're going to end up needing that fifth pitcher, basically.
Yeah, and LSU would like to avoid that if possible. Right now they're tied for third with Ole Miss, UGA, and Mississippi State. But we'll see. It is going to be interesting how each one performs this weekend. And here's the thing, if you're the dad, man, that's a tough spot, right? Because your job is to manage the young men that you have in your dugout, and you want them to win, and you know how big of a deal it is to come to Alex Box Stadium and beat LSU because you used to be an LSU Tiger. But on the same hand, you want to see your boy do well, right? You want to see him succeed. He's going to be out there, and he's going to have his pitcher, and he's going to have the range of emotions. If his pitcher strikes out his son, or if his pitcher goes out there and strikes out his own boy, he's going to be happy for his pitcher for striking out and getting out of a jam, but then on the same hand, his heart's going to hurt a little bit because his boy struck out. And vice versa, if his boy gets a two-run double,
right,
or a home run, he's going to be happy. So I'm interested to see when the camera pans to his face, is he going to be able to be stoic? Is he going to be able to be like, nothing affects me. I have no emotion. I'm the Terminator. Or, you know, are they going to catch a glimpse? That's the part of me. Are they going to catch a glimpse if his boy does something good and he'll be like, you'll see him, and he'll start to do the clap, and then he'll catch it mid-clap and go, oh, no.
No.
And he'll do this. Oh, and then he'll do like a stretch. He'll try to turn it into like a
grab a bag stretch of sunflower seeds.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was just putting my hands together, and he just rubs them together like he's putting lotion on.
The old Les Miles clap.
Yeah.
I wonder if at family dinner tonight, I mean, could Mike avoid, hey, Drew, when you're at the plate, you need to keep that front shoulder in a little tighter.
Oh,
you need
that's
to,
hard,
you,
right?
You need to get your timing down a little bit. That front step is a little long. You need to shorten that up quicker with your hands. Can you really avoid trying? Because you know he's been watching. You know, and as his dad and as a very good baseball coach, he knows he has things he wants
give his
to
son
say.
Tips. I think it'll be in general terms. Like,
right,
hey,
that's what I mean.
You're not
keep
turning
your shoulder
your
in, or right. Yeah, just things like
he'll
that.
He'll do something like that. Now he's not going to give him a scouting.
Yeah, know. yeah. My guy on Friday night, watch out for his slider. He's got a real good one.
So you don't want that to occur. You want to give him some general tips, maybe more about keeping your head up, son. You know, don't be discouraged. You know, you're a good player. You have immense talent. You just got to work through it. We all did it. I had to do it. I remember Skip Burden telling me it'll be that kind of stuff, right?
Right.
It won't be an advanced scouting report. Now, if his boy goes and tees off and has like a 3-for-5 performance with 4 ribbies on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, there may be some questions that the Ole Miss athletic director is going to have to ask. come Monday, but I doubt that's going to happen because Mike's a pro. So,
He won't give him an advanced scouting report, but now I still hope Drew Bianco just goes off and forces that question to be asked. You know what I mean? Just put that AD at Ole Miss in that position. That'd be great. A clean sweep. Bianco hits 4 home runs. He's got 12 RBIs. It'd be great. So much fun.
The greatest weekend ever in Alex Box Stadium pitches, history for a weekend series.
He throws a shutout. He's not even a pitcher. He just gets on the mound, throws a shutout.
Bring him in. Bring him in. Going to bring him in. He's just going to do everything. He's going to go afterwards. He's going to rake the infield, repaint the lines.
What if we had like a Sting, like NWO Wolfpack type moment where Bianco comes out and then at the end of Sunday when the sweep is completed and LSU has beat Ole Miss 3 games out of 3, Bianco walks out to the middle of the field and he rips off his Ole Miss jersey and he's got an LSU jersey on underneath and everybody's like, oh, he joined the Tigers. Oh, kind of like Sting, except when Sting did it, he ripped off the NWO shirt to reveal the Wolfpack shirt, to then only rip off the Wolfpack shirt again to reveal another NWO shirt, because swerves.
I miss the old, like, blonde-haired Sting.
No.
With, like, the teal pants.
The only Sting that sucks is the Sting without his face paint. That Sting sucks.
Well, back then he still had the face paint.
I was at the WWE Hall of Fame at WrestleMania 32 when Sting was inducted, and he did the entire ceremony without face paint. Really weird. Really, really. At least when Warrior went in, Warrior didn't paint his face, but he put on like a plastic mask that looked like the face paint. Sting couldn't even oblige
that. The Warrior probably
sunglasses. He was sunglasses, Sting.
The Warrior probably wears that mask in the morning, too, while vacuuming his house.
Well Warrior is not wearing anything except a suit in his final resting place now. R.I.P. Ultimate Warrior.
Yeah, speaking of awkwardness, that was Speaking of awkwardness, it will be somewhat awkward tonight for the families there involved with LSU and Ole Miss baseball. But it should be a hell of an entertaining series this weekend at Alex Box Stadium. I'll be venturing over on Saturday, Cody. I'll be there. I'm going to take in a game at the box. When we come back here on RP3 and Company, we will put a bow on it right here on 103.7 The Game. Welcome back to RP3 in Company right here on 103.7 The Game. We are broadcasting, as always, from the 237 Roof Studios, presented by Lafayette Roofing. Simulcast on KXKW Channel 32.1 Stadium Sports Network. Programming reminder, up next, Sport of Politics from 9 to 10. After that, DP and the Boys, Dan Patrick Show from 10 to 11, followed by a half hour of Jim Rome. Why are we taking Jim Rome away from you? Because we're replacing it with something better. That's right, Houston Astros Day Baseball. Pre-game show, Astro Launch, starts at 11:30 right here on 103.7 The Game. First pitch, 12:10, Astros at the Minnesota Twins, live from Target Field there in Minneapolis. Also this afternoon, the good brother himself, Ben Love, host of Bumper to Bumper Sports. B2BS will be live at the Tap Room in River Ranch. They got the great deals, great atmosphere. Go check out Ben live in person or just listen to him right here on 103.7 The Game. I want to thank our guest that did come on today's show, John Marques from The Town Talk and thetowntalk.com, joining us, helping us break down his thoughts on the Will Wade situation at LSU, plus insight on the Superdome renovation project. I also want to thank Caleb Clark, senior from St. Thomas More High School. He's the defending state champion in bass fishing. He and the rest of the Cougars are going to be bound for Morgan City this weekend for the state championships. He made some time for us talking about what it takes to be a state champion and his bond with his famous grandfather, the Louisiana Sports Hall of Famer and the first man to win the Bassmaster Classic, Mr. Jack Haynes. Also want to thank James Yasko for coming on, co-host of the Lima Time podcast, giving his insight on the Astros' kind of inconsistent season so far, the fact that he's not worried about the hitting woes of Jose Altuve, and the fact that Brantley has been such a great pickup for the Stros. Also, thanks to Les East, our good friend, Mr. Reliable himself, from CrescentCitySports.com, coming on and helping us out, giving us his thoughts on the Superdome renovation project, the Saints draft picks, and as well as David Griffin's first hire as the leader of the Pelicans front office. You know what? I want to take a moment to thank you, Cody Schutz, for doing a tremendous job. A lot of guests today, a lot of moving parts. You stepped your game up, my friend. Good job today.
Thank you. I would like to add that being released early this morning at like 2 a.m., Detective Pikachu is going to be released in a 270-degree panoramic Screen X format. So prepare yourselves for that. The world's largest cinema screen will bring you Detective Pikachu, so I'm excited for that. You think I'm making it up, but you know I'm not. Like, you would like to think, oh, he's just being ridiculous. You know I'm telling the truth.
I'm not going to lie. The first time I heard about Detective Pikachu,
okay,
I thought it was a prank. Like, I thought it was, like, a special feature for, like,
well, it's a video
Deadpool.
Game. It's a game, first of all. It is a video game, Detective Pikachu.
Because Ryan Reynolds is voicing Pikachu, right?
Well, that was just out of left field. No one saw that coming.
It's genius.
Yeah.
It's genius, because you got Deadpool now voicing the little yellow monster thing. What is it?
He's an electric mouse. You watch your mouth.
Cody Schutz will cut somebody over Pokemon. Oh,
let's just end the show now. You've upset me.
I've upset.
I have upsetment.
I've upset you too much. All right, Mad Titan Thanos, calm down. Calm down. No need to snap us into existence. Also, congrats to Drake for taking his Drake curse from the sporting arenas into HBO dramas.
Medieval times.
So, good luck, Game of Thrones and Game of Thrones fans. If something happens to one of your favorite characters, blame Drake. That's what I do. I blame Drake for many things, but we don't have time for that. The show's over now. We'll talk to y'all tomorrow. This is 103.7 The Game.